Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Welcome in, Outkick the Coverage Tuesday edition. I appreciate all of you, wherever you may be across this country or this great world. So I am utterly fascinated by this as the NCAA tournament gets closer and closer. We've got play-in games going on tonight. I'm excited to see how those are going to go. I'm rooting for Belmont to pull off the win. It's the Nashville guy factor in for me. I love Rick Byrd in that game that's going to be going on in the play-in. But I'm also utterly fascinated by this question. Is Zion bigger than Duke? I can't remember an NCAA tournament, guys, where I was more excited to watch a player than I am to watch Zion play for Duke. And what's fascinating about this, if you watched us talk about this yesterday, I'm out in LA, and I was on Jason Whitlock's show at the start of his show, Speak for Yourself, and we were talking about this. I don't remember. We talked about this a little bit yesterday too, but we talked about this on the show on yesterday as well. I don't remember a player ever transcending his team in college basketball more than Zion is transcending Duke and their brand right now. All right, I want you to think about this with me. When you think about Duke basketball, typically, what do you think about? The hated player. Sometimes those are white guys, right? Hating the Duke white player is like a national college basketball festival, right? Whether it was back in the day, Christian Laettner, most recently, whether it was Grayson Allen, J.J. Redick, Steve Wojciechowski, who's now the coach now of Marquette. There was always that white guy who played for Duke that the nation united and seemed to hate. Cherokee Parks, even back in the day. And partly, I think that's because Duke represents, as Jason Whitlock argued yesterday on Speak for Yourself, a certain brand of elitism. You don't really feel like Duke has the scrappy guy on its team in the same way that other places do, right? And there's just a certain thing about Duke, and I think partly it comes out of the state of North Carolina, where we got a lot of people listening right now. The state of North Carolina's blue blood program, if you live in the state of North Carolina most of the time, is UNC, right? They're the Tar Heels. They're the not from the East Coast elitist, right? When you think about the Duke brand, Duke became an elite institution by being fundamentally un-Southern, right? North Carolina is the down-home Southern school in the state of North Carolina that if you grow up rooting for, you tend to be from the state of North Carolina. You walk around Duke's campus, they brought in a bunch of people from New York, from New Jersey, from all the way down the East Coast, and that's how they became the elite school. They're a private school, right? And then you have UNC, which is one of the public Ivies, a great public institution, but there's a big cultural difference in the Tar Heel state between Duke and UNC. And honestly, Zion feels like the kind of player who would typically go to UNC. He feels like the kind of player who would typically go to Kentucky. Blue blood programs, but blue blood programs that don't necessarily have that patina of elitism like Duke. I can't even think, guys, of a player who is in the remote category of belovedness like Zion is right now in college basketball that has ever played for Duke. Jason Williams back in the day, maybe pretty liked. Grant Hill back in the day, pretty liked. None of them were remotely the same as how much people are loving Zion right now. And we had this debate on Speak for Yourself yesterday, and I thought it was a fascinating one because my argument is not that Zion is triumphing over Duke hate. It's that Zion already has branded himself as so much distinct from Duke that Zion is bigger than the university at Duke. No player at Duke has ever been a bigger, more transcendent figure at any point in his time playing for Duke than Zion is right now. And no Duke player has ever been more beloved than Zion is right now either. And so, this opens up an interesting avenue from a purely business perspective. How brilliant was it of Zion to go to college basketball? There's a lot of people out there, I'm one of them, who typically says, hey, if you're 18 years old, you should have to go straight in to the NBA if you so desire. That worked for LeBron. It worked for Tracy McGrady. It worked for Kevin Garnett. It worked for Kobe Bryant. All those guys went to the NBA and became luminescent superstars without ever having to play 1 minute of college basketball. But I don't think it would have worked for Zion. I think Zion uniquely may have been the biggest beneficiary of one and done in the history of the rule. Because Zion wasn't going to be the overall number one pick in the draft prior to what he did on the court this year. He has played at such an unbelievable level that nobody else has been able to ascend anywhere near him in terms of his overall accomplishments. And you start to think about that, Zion not only has gone to Duke and dominated, he's made himself hundreds of millions of dollars that he would have never made if he hadn't gone to Duke, if he hadn't gone to college basketball. Because I do think going to Duke was smart because the brand of Duke is massive. But I think if Zion had gone to UNC, he would be just as big of a star. And I think if Zion had gone to Kentucky, he would be just as big of a star. I think there are lots of teams, as long as he is on a top five team that's going to be on television a ton, I think that Zion would have been just as big of a star if he had gone to those teams. But what I think I got wrong about Zion was I said I didn't think Zion was going to come back and play. And I said, if I came back and played, I didn't think he would play anywhere near as well as he played in the ACC tournament. He scored 81 points. I believe that's the most points ever scored in the ACC tournament by any freshman. Been a lot of good freshmen in the ACC. It's the best anybody's ever done. What I think I didn't necessarily give enough credence to is how great it has been for Zion's brand to get to play at Duke. And how great it is for the NBA that now the interest level in Zion is off the charts when he enters into the league in a way it wouldn't have been if he had gone straight to the league. Let me explain something. DeAndre Ayton was the overall number one pick. He's playing with the Phoenix Suns now, right? Playing really well. The Suns have actually played very well down the stretch. They went and beat the Warriors on the road. DeAndre Ayton, I think, is going to be a very good NBA player. How many of you have watched a DeAndre Ayton game this year? Be honest, right now, you're riding around in your car, you're on your way to work. How many of you have sat and watched a DeAndre Ayton game playing for the Phoenix Suns? How many of you, conversely, have watched Zion Williamson play this year? Zion has been exposed to more people in the world of basketball playing college this year than DeAndre Ayton has playing pro. Being on a great team in college helps your brand immensely. On top of that, the best thing that could have ever happened to Zion Williamson's career from a money perspective, you know what it was? That shoe blowing up on him. The moment that shoe blew up, everybody out there knew that this guy was going to sign the biggest sneaker deal in the history of rookies in the NBA. I'm not even kidding about that. Because Nike's going to have to pay him infinitely more. They're already going to have to pay him a lot if they're going to sign him. Under Armour, the Fila, whoever else is out there, Reebok, Puma, Adidas, whatever other tennis shoes are out there, if they can get him signed, imagine the ad opportunities they will have to denigrate the Nike product if they sign him. I'm telling you right now, Nike cannot allow Zion Williamson to sign with anybody else. You know how smart this kid is? He did a live stream playing video games. You know what he was wearing in that live stream? An entire Adidas outfit. This guy is going to be able to sign the likes of which a deal we have never seen before. Because he has branded himself as bigger than Duke because his play is so effervescent, powerful, and because he's something we've never seen before. I don't think we've seen the peak of Zion's abilities, nowhere near it. This guy, when he actually starts working on the craft of basketball throughout, it's going to be the sky being the limit. So long as he can stay healthy, this guy is going to be the biggest entry to the NBA since LeBron James. LeBron James obviously entered into the NBA, number one overall pick. Cleveland Cavaliers get him. They were able to turn him into a superstar before he got to the NBA. But Zion has done that uniquely because he's taken advantage of the opportunities of social media to build apprehension for himself. It's like a movie trailer that comes out, right? The movie trailer comes out and you're like, man, I'd kind of like to see that. And it just builds the interest and you see it coming, like Game of Thrones is going to be out soon. Game of Thrones is giving you just enough. Every time one of those highlight clips come out, I'm like, hey, I'm kind of curious to see what's going to happen with Game of Thrones. But Game of Thrones is different because you already know it's good. Zion is like a movie that's going to come out that hasn't quite come out that's slowly piquing your interest. That's what Instagram did for him. All these dunks, the fact that there's nobody like Zion Williamson, the fact that he is a freak on a different level. And people had the opportunity suddenly to see him at Duke, and the question was, is he going to live up to the hype, or is he going to just be an okay player? Because there's a lot of talent on Duke already. And Zion hasn't just lived up to the hype. He has vastly exceeded it, such that I am as excited to watch him play in the NCAA tournament as anybody out there. And this is where I got something wrong. I said that his brand would be strengthened enormously already, that he didn't need to come back and play. I think I was wrong on that. I think the fact that he came back and played so dominantly in the ACC tournament is going to help his brand infinitely more than if he had gone straight into the NBA and never played again and set out for the NCAA tournament. I think this makes him infinitely more likable, and I think it gives him a hurdle to overcome, a moment of adversity, which in sports is what we love. We love the challenge of adversity. We love our athletes to overcome that adversity. I think Zion is as big as anybody has ever been at Duke, and I think as a freshman, he's as big of a player as college basketball has ever had. And by the way, the ratings reflect that. Duke games are off the charts, never watched more before in the regular season, and I think the tournament's going to take it to another level because there are a lot of people out there who are maybe not casual, not big college basketball fans, casual fans. They don't even know about Zion yet. They've just heard the rumors. They're going to all come pouring in to watch these big Duke games, and it's going to be off the charts. I can't wait to see what's going to happen.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios, Tuesday edition of the program. All right, so Clay, I heard you and saw you on Speak for Yourself yesterday talking about Zion Williamson. You made an interesting point as it relates to what the long-term effects of having a Zion Williamson, an incredibly likable, and I heard your Monday show when you said Zion's the most likable guy that Duke's ever had, and I agree, and the number two on that list for me is Grant Hill, and I'm not sure there's even a close guy to him in terms of somebody that was also pretty likable from the very beginning, but Zion's on a completely different level. So what do you think in terms of what does Zion do for Duke long-term, or does he do anything for Duke long-term?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Because that was what Jason Whitlock and I were talking about. Marcellus Wiley also had Cousin Sal on with us. And the debate was, is this a different Duke, right? And this is a question we've asked before, because to Coach K's credit, he's evolved. And for a long time, Duke was, we don't believe in one-and-dones, right? Like, that was kind of the mantra that that Coach K had as John Calipari ran up the one-and-dones. And I think to Kentucky's credit, John Calipari basically found a loophole, right? It was an ability for Kentucky to go get the best players and be able to contend for championships, and nobody else. There was kind of like this pariah factor associated with the one-and-dones. Nobody else wanted to try and do it. And then they saw how much success Coach Cal had, and finally Krzyzewski got into the market, and I think Zion represents the culmination of that. Now, here's what I think, and I'm curious what you think, J-Mart, is when you look at Zion, to me, Zion is a transcendent athlete, but he's more about the name on the back of the jersey than he is the name on the front of the jersey. And what I mean by that is, if Zion had gone to Kentucky or UNC or Michigan State or Michigan or really any other primo program in the country where you know they were going to have a top five or top ten program this year. I'd even include in that group right now Tennessee, Virginia, you know, any of these programs, Gonzaga, that are going to get number one overall seeds. I think Zion, maybe not Gonzaga because it's West Coast and it's hard to keep up for West Coast, but I think any East Coast program, Kansas you could throw in there too, any big-time basketball program, I think Zion would be just as big of a story there as he is at Duke. Do you agree or disagree with that? Because to me, this doesn't represent a changing of the guard at Duke. I think it's just emblematic of how much of a star and how beloved Zion is, more so than it means anything else.
No, I agree. I mean, I think Zion has that, like, LeBron cachet. There are very few players that it's about them. It's not necessarily about the school. And that really shows how transcendent Zion is, because Duke is a name that carries all the weight in the world when it comes to college basketball. Syracuse, another story. You go back to like a Carmelo Anthony, it wasn't even as big as Zion Williamson is now. And then I look at it from the opposite side and say somebody like Ja Morant at Murray State, who has gotten a lot of things said about him, he could have gone somewhere else and he still would have a lot of things said about him. It's not going to affect Murray State at all. Like, Murray State's going to go back to being Murray State as soon as the number three pick upcoming in the NBA draft leaves their team whenever they get beat in the NCAA tournament. But Zion is an unquantifiable kind of asset to have, and I don't think that it matters whether or not he's playing in Durham or whether or not he's playing in Austin, Texas, or whether or not, you know, wherever it is that he plays, he was going to have the cameras on him because he had the cameras on him when he was in high school. So it didn't necessarily matter that he decided to go play for Coach K. That just helped out Duke because Duke was able to land him. But yeah, I think Zion is a star that transcends the sport of college basketball.
And here's the other question I have. Does it change anything about Duke? Because, and that was the debate we had with Jason Whitlock. Duke is, for Whitlock, Duke is an elite academic institution, and he felt like he didn't really like Duke necessarily because they always tried to pretend that they were better than everybody else, right? And we got into a big discussion, and this is a big discussion for me. I think there's a difference between the meritocracy and the aristocracy. And what I mean by that is Duke very often feels like the aristocracy. And for people out there who may not understand the difference, when I say meritocracy, I mean in America, we like the idea that no matter where you're from, if you're the best, you can rise up and become president, or you can rise up and become Michael Jordan or LeBron James, right? That the great thing about athletics in my mind is that it's all meritocracy. It doesn't matter who your dad was, doesn't matter who your mom was. By and large, ultimately, talent elevates. And that's one reason that so many people listening to us right now love athletics. But I think where we get a conflict is Duke can also represent the aristocracy. And I'm going to talk some with Petros Papadakis about this in hour three, because that's what rubs so many people the wrong way, I feel like, about this buying into admissions, getting into colleges aspect of things. It's like the George W. Bush kind of level arrogance at times of you're standing on third base, you were born on third base, and you think you hit a triple, right? That, you know, like, oh, I'm so accomplished, and really there is an element of your family that has allowed you to end up there. And so I think there is an aristocratic element to Duke that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Particularly, you can speak to this better than most. You lived in North Carolina, yes, and Virginia and South Carolina. Like, UNC is the school that you go to if you are a member of the meritocracy. Yep. I think a lot of people in North Carolina who are listening to us right now, you're a North Carolinian-based school. And yes, I understand some of those people go to NC State and some of them go to other schools. But Duke brings in all these East Coast blue bloods, and I feel like that's a big reason why there's that cultural conflict between Duke and UNC. UNC is the state school. Duke is the private school. Duke is their aristocracy, and I think UNC would see itself as the meritocracy.
Yeah, to some extent, but there's an aristocracy about Carolina too, not to the extent of Duke. I mean, Duke's a completely different animal, and most of the hatred towards Duke doesn't necessarily go to the players, it goes to the fans. It goes to the people in the seats at Cameron Indoor, and it's kind of always been that way.
But there's also a lot of hate. I mean, like,
yeah,
J.J. Redick,
yeah, absolutely,
Grayson Allen. Like, if you are the white Duke basketball player, you are typically the most hated player, and you're good. You are typically the most hated player every year in college basketball, right? If you're a star, whether it's J.J. Redick, Grayson Allen, certainly any of those guys, going all the way back to Christian Laettner, there's a level of hate that exists for those guys that doesn't exist for other players in college basketball.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with that. That's absolutely true. And, I mean, there are a lot of players that aren't white that also are hated for the same reason at Duke, but white is a completely different animal when it comes to that. But yeah, no, I think that's very true. I don't think that Duke, I mean, the thing about it is there are players that have come to Duke that were not blue bloods in any respect that came up a lot harder than I did, for example, like Brandon Ingram, who's from Kinston, North Carolina, which is a very, very tough area. For example, there are guys that have come out of there, Brian Davis, famously from those big time teams that had Laettner and Bobby Hurley, Brian Davis came up really, really hard as well. That was one of the things that was pointed out in that Fab Five documentary and in the I Hate Christian Laettner documentary, that yep. Some of the hate for Duke is somewhat misplaced because there is a perception that everybody that steps on the floor from there had a silver spoon in their mouth from birth, and that's not true. It's just been a narrative that's been created. But you're definitely right when it comes to the Grayson Allens, the Steve Wojciechowskis, the Christian Laettners, the Bobby Hurleys, those guys. They get a rap that is quite frankly unfair. Remember what happened? We talked about it last week, Clay, when Syracuse tripped Zion Williamson.
Oh yeah!
Imagine if that had been one of the guys we just mentioned. Yeah, it went totally away.
Story died immediately. Whereas Grayson Allen, when he trips somebody, it's like the lead story for multiple days. A Syracuse player trips Zion, who's a much bigger star, being tripped in a bigger situation than anything. Grayson, it's like Grayson Allen ever tripped the presumptive number one overall NBA yeah. pick, and Grayson Allen was all that's evil in the world, and this other Syracuse guy, that story's already disappeared. It's like it never really took off. And by the way, I think a lot of the hate for Duke players is, I always think that white people who are college basketball fans, the majority of them, feel more comfortable because of the legacy of racism and everything else, hating a white guy, right? I feel like they don't feel the same level of disdain and worry about how their motivations are going to be perceived. It's easy to hate Grayson Allen if you're a white kid in a student body at Wake Forest or at North Carolina or whatever, in a way that it wouldn't necessarily be, I think, if that was a black player, right? And I think that's one reason that the venom is so pronounced, because it's white guys, white athletes, being attacked by other primarily white fans, really. I think that's where it stems from.
Well, you remember Tyler Hansbrough at Carolina?
Yeah.
Another example. I mean, he wasn't a Duke, but he was still at a pretty elite institution. Tyler Hansbrough took it on the chin all the time, pretty much throughout his career. And I think people wished to see him fail when he got to the NBA. And I think that it's basically the exact same thing you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly there have been, remember Matt Walsh at Florida?
Yes.
Oh, God, Matt Walsh just got crushed for years at Florida in a way that I think other players did not. And so I do think it's an intriguing question about the Zion story for the next six games, assuming that Duke were able to make it to the title game, and for as long as his career remains, is going to be one that is difficult to ignore. And I wonder on some level, as you see all the people who have come in and are already watching Zion, you and me and most of our listeners already are aware of what Zion and Duke's story is. But what I always tell people is the NCAA tournament is when you become a star, right? Because suddenly 20 million people might be watching you. As big as the audience we may think is for, like, let's say Duke and Carolina so far this year, 3 million people watched,
yeah,
right? When you're in one of these Final Four games and there are 20 million people that are sitting down to watch, that's when stars are truly made. And it's wild to think about, and I always say this about the Super Bowl too, it's like the audience for the AFC and the NFC championship games is big, but the Super Bowl is a different level entirely. The most people to ever watch Zion Williamson play basketball so far is sitting right around 3.5 million. 20 million people are still to come, and they're going to come late to the Zion story, and he's going to go from a famous college basketball player to a luminescent star streaking across the night sky.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And when you really think about Zion Williamson as important to college basketball, there are those folks that are out there saying he's overhyped. I'm tired of all the Zion Williamson stuff. My question to you is, not to you, but to those people, would be, why? What else is there in college basketball that has you tremendously excited? It's a sport that doesn't mean what it did 20 years ago. Zion Williamson is somebody that's actually appointment television. Put all the hype on him that you want. I understand why the four-letter is showing Zion Williamson constantly, and why he's on the bracketology special on Sunday and all that. Why wouldn't he be? Who else is exciting enough that actually makes you want to tune into a college basketball season? Not now. I mean, we're all going to be watching the NCAA tournament. We get that. And we watched a lot of these conference tournaments. But regular season basketball at Duke mattered more than even it has in decades because Zion Williamson is that must watch. Like, he is appointment TV in a sport that is anything but at this point.
Oh, I'm sure some people out there are going to be saying, oh my God, you're talking about Zion 2 days in a row.
Of course we are.
And I'm going to say, yeah, I do a national radio show, and we are now, you know, the play-in game is going to happen tonight, and we are in the midst of getting ready. I'm going to hop a flight later this evening to go to Vegas to do a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday show. And you know who we're going to talk about on television every day the rest of this week, too? Tonight, on this afternoon on television, I'm going to talk about Zion. And Wednesday on the television show, you know who we're going to talk about? Zion. Mm-hmm. And Thursday and Friday, too. And probably next week, assuming Duke doesn't lose. And guess what? If Duke loses, we're going to talk about Zion on Monday because Duke will have lost in a huge upset to an 8-9 or, God forbid, a 16 seed. So, you know, Zion is, I think, as interesting of a story. And this is what I opened off the show talking about today. I think he's as interesting of a story when you consider him entering the NBA after this year. As big and as interesting of a story as anyone going all the way back to LeBron James. I think that's how many years it's been since there will be a team drafting a guy with as much interest out there as is about Zion right now. And I utterly am fascinated to see how he's going to do in the tournament and to see whether or not he can rise up to the same level that he did in the ACC tournament when he set an all-time freshman record for most points to be scored.
Yeah, I mean, he makes things exciting. Tuesday edition rolling right along on Fox Sports Radio. Clay Travis out in Los Angeles. I'm Jason Martin here in Nashville. He's at Clay Travis. I'm at JMartZone. Coming up in the final segment, Sean McVay turned Jared Goff's career around. Can he do that with Blake Bortles? Because that's a thing. Blake Bortles to the Rams. We'll talk about that next. I'll kick the coverage. Fox Sports Radio. Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios, finishing off hour number one here, Tuesday edition, Outkick the Coverage radio program, Fox Sports Radio, anywhere in the country, foxsportsradio.com, 24-7, 365, consume it how you want, when you want, where you want, via the podcast, search Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis, and you can get our entire archive, don't miss a single second, and you can get it and consume it however you wish. We welcome you back. Final segment this hour, Clay is out in Los Angeles. I'm Jason Martin here in Nashville. Clay, Blake Bortles, no longer a Jacksonville Jaguar. Now he is an L.A. Ram. He's with Sean McVay, who did wonders for Jared Goff after Jeff Fisher exited stage left. What do you think about Blake Bortles to the Rams? And also, maybe in addition to that, Ryan Tannehill, now right here in Nashville as the backup to Marcus Mariota. Two guys who have extensive starting experience in this league now thrust into backup roles.
Yeah, and which one do you feel like buying stock in more at this point in time? Obviously, Blake Bortles and Ryan Tannehill's careers both look bad. But if you went back several years ago, and as Nick Foles kind of tried to make a career as a backup quarterback, you could have bought stock in Nick Foles really, really low, too. So is there any chance that either Tannehill or Bortles could remake their career and find a success, you know, coming off the bench as a second-teamer? And I don't know. I mean, my early read here is Sean McVay is such a good quarterback coach that if Jared Goff went out and got injured, you know, and Ram fans had suddenly an injury to deal with at the quarterback position, I feel better about Blake Bortles' ability to be brought in and groomed into a decent quarterback in that Ram offense than I do with Ryan Tannehill, where you're talking about a first-year offensive coordinator and a guy in Mike Vrabel who's not a quarterback guru. So to me, this is not a bad move at all for Blake Bortles. Right now, just as coaches all want to be connected to Sean McVay because of what it can represent for their future success, I don't know why at the same time you wouldn't want to be connected to him if you're a player. Because if you're Blake Bortles, you have to change the narrative, and the narrative is that you are a guy who's inaccurate and can't consistently make plays. We know that the best of Blake Bortles has been pretty good. It was almost good enough to take a team to the Super Bowl and win three playoff games, right? The guy managed to beat Tyrod Taylor in what was an ugly game against the Bills when he was with the Jags. Then he went on the road, put up a pretty good performance in that win that the Jacksonville Jaguars managed in their game against the Steelers. And then if they had been a little bit more aggressive in their play calling, then maybe they would have gone to the Super Bowl a couple of years ago and been playing against Nick Foles and the Eagles. And so if I'm Blake Bortles, I think it's a pretty smart move.
I mean, I think it could be. I think that the interesting thing about Tannehill here in Nashville is that Tannehill's skill set from a passing perspective and what he's used to in terms of his offense, he fits better as a backup because he does similar things to what Marcus does. I don't know necessarily. Blake Bortles is more of an athlete than he is a thrower. Now, that's not to say Sean McVay won't put him in positions to throw because of the way they use the play action and the way that they try to run the football. You couldn't go anywhere better right now, I don't think, if you were Blake Bortles, than to go to Sean McVay, because we've seen what he can do to rehab a young career. Blake Bortles has been in the league a few years longer. His name has been maligned for a long time. If there's anybody that could be the perfect kind of rehab coach, he's basically, Blake Bortles at this point is going to that like very picturesque setting on a hill somewhere where you go in and try to knock that cocaine habit, and you're there and you're doing all the meditation and things like that. You want a fresh start. There's nowhere better that you could go to get your chi right as a quarterback than to go to Sean McVay, I would say.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you look at what people were saying about Jared Goff when Sean McVay got the Rams job, it was that he was a colossal bust. And that that he was not proving to be anywhere near worthy of the number one overall pick. And that storyline changed almost immediately as soon as he started getting the opportunity to work alongside of Sean McVay. So I think you can make the case, whether or not it's going to end up being proven true or not, who knows. But I think you can make the case that there's a possibility that, much like happened with Nick Foles, if an injury were to arise, that Sean McVay is such a talented quarterback whisperer that he could, remember this is a one-year deal, that he could bring in Blake Bortles and help to redeem him in some way, where when Bortles is done with this year, that maybe he could get a chance to sign with somebody who would give him a chance to start.
Yeah. And, I mean, what you said about Nick Foles, you and I disagree on Nick Foles, and I really need you to just kind of explain your Joe Flacco take that I heard secondhand a couple of days ago, that you actually think that might work out for my Denver Broncos. I'm crying myself to sleep right now with Joe Flacco being the quarterback, especially when you look at Case Keenum having a better 2 years previously to this than Joe Flacco does. But what you ultimately want in a backup is a guy where it's not that far off the pace of your starter. You can't replace an Aaron Rodgers, but you need somebody that can at least run the offense to a decent degree. Or you need somebody that does something completely different that's impossible to prepare for on short notice. Like if you've got a pocket passer, then you bring in somebody with a skill set similar to a Lamar Jackson. You don't find Lamar Jacksons everywhere. Then Lamar Jackson can win a couple of games for you because there's not that same level of tape, and whatever you've prepared for has changed. So if somebody gets injured in the first quarter, then comes Lamar Jackson, you're not prepared for that necessarily. So the backup quarterback, really, he could be a starter, but ultimately he's going to win you about 8 games as a starter, so he's better suited as a backup. I think Blake Bortles is about a 6-8 win quarterback, generally, at least against mediocre competition. They're not going to beat the elite teams very often, but Blake Bortles did manage to beat the Patriots this past year. So I think this is a risk worth taking, because it's not like the backup quarterback market was particularly strong. The other interesting thing I thought about was Ryan Fitzpatrick going to the Dolphins. I said on the Jason Martin Show on Sunday morning here on Fox Sports Radio, Clay, that if there was ever a situation where if there was a chance for Kaepernick to play again, that's the place. It's a place where there's no starter at all, because you can't bring him in as a backup. The fact that Miami went with Fitzpatrick, which I think they made the right decision based on what we've seen when he goes places, he tries to make the most of those opportunities. I think we both agree. I don't think Kaepernick's ever going to play football again. And I'm not talking about from a political standpoint. I just think he's been away from the game too long, and there's still enough toxicity around him that it's not worth the risk, because in most cases you cannot bring him in and assume he could ever start for you.
Well, I think it's interesting for the Miami Dolphins in particular. I think the Castro thing really killed any possibility of Colin Kaepernick. I had that conversation with Jason Whitlock off the air after he was tweeting that he thought maybe Kaepernick to the Dolphins made the most sense. I said, you know what, if Kaepernick hadn't shown up in a Castro shirt and praised Castro in the way that he had treated people in Cuba as someone that we should seek to follow their path, then I thought to myself, you know, maybe there would have been a possibility of giving him a chance in Miami, but I think that basically sandbagged and killed any chance that he had there. Tannehill, you know, and this is such a Titans move, it hurts. Yeah. Only the Tennessee Titans, by the way, could make the decision to bring in a backup quarterback for Marcus Mariota, a guy who certainly has had injury issues, with a guy who's had even worse injury issues. I said the other day that I had no doubt that at some point in time the Titans would manage next year to have both Mariota and Tannehill knocked out in the same game, and that we would end up with Derrick Henry running the football around, right? Like, I mean, that is just the most Titan move imaginable.
Yeah, I tweeted out that I didn't want to make the joke, but basically the Titans are the worst Voltron of all time, because with those two quarterbacks, maybe you get one 16-game quarterback, because both of them are so injured.
I do think that he is a substantial improvement, over what they had before with Blake Bortles.
You might have been with Blaine Gabbert. I definitely think that you might have been better than Gabbert against the Colts in that regular season finale.
I think I said Blake Bortles and Blaine Gabbert, like all these names just run together.
It's the same. Yeah. It's absolutely the same. So those are not elite quarterbacks. There is an elite quarterback who's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer in Ben Roethlisberger. How petty is Ben Roethlisberger? We will debate that coming up next. Stick with us. Outkick the Coverage here on Fox Sports Radio.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We are coming to you live from the Geico Outkick Studios Tuesday. Appreciate all of you as we roll into hour two, second hour of Outkick the Coverage. I'm doing the show from L.A. We got Jason Martin sitting in and hanging out with us a decent amount during this show as well. We are scheduled to be joined by Petros Papadakis in hour three. We'll dive into that USC scandal and more. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us for right now. In the meantime, a couple of things that I wanted to run into that are substantial stories that everybody has been talking about. First of all, I think this is a pretty wild story in general. The allegation that Ben Roethlisberger intentionally fumbled the football and all of the drama coming out of Pittsburgh. Guys, would you have ever believed that of all of the places in the NFL, if you looked at the Rooney family and everything they have represented and everything that entire basically institution, it is an institution, the Pittsburgh Steelers, would you have ever believed that they would end up being the center of drama that they have ended up being? And I think the question you have to ask is, and I think it's a tough question because Mike Tomlin has been insanely successful, what has happened in Pittsburgh that has created all of this drama? Because if you look at the rest of the NFL, there's not very much drama out there at all, right? You think about this. We've got the drama associated with Le'Veon Bell. I talked about this last week. I think Le'Veon Bell made a bad decision to sit out. I think that his overall decision-making in general for everything surrounding his contract was an utter disaster, right? I think that he got played. I think that he allowed his ego to get the better of him. But that situation doesn't arise in one day, right? This is a slowly festering issue between Le'Veon Bell and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Who usually fixes a festering issue? Either the owner or the head coach. Very rarely is it the GM. And I think the guy who sees him on a regular basis, sees Le'Veon Bell, has an interpersonal relationship with him, is Mike Tomlin. And the fact that Mike Tomlin allowed the Le'Veon Bell situation to accelerate to the point where he sits out an entire season rather than reporting is wild. Okay? So I think that's number one on the drama scene. Number two on the drama scene, Antonio Brown. Antonio Brown is an elite-level wide receiving talent. If you are the Pittsburgh Steelers, you cannot allow your relationship with Antonio Brown to be so poisoned that ultimately you have to trade him and eat $21 million on your salary cap, and in exchange for Antonio Brown, you only get a third and a fifth round pick. That's a failure of the highest magnitude. To me, Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown, the responsibility to a large extent lies with Mike Tomlin. And now we've got the story about Ben Roethlisberger potentially fumbling intentionally on the field, according to one of his former teammates. If that is going on as well, then the three biggest stars that you have had on your team over the past several years, Ben Roethlisberger, certainly Le'Veon Bell, and Antonio Brown, have all created a cataclysmic failure, the likes of which we don't typically see in the NFL. Think about this for a minute. Who else is out there in the world of the NFL that provokes anywhere near this kind of reaction among other teammates? Right? Just think about this for right now. The NBA is filled with drama. There are guys constantly moving teams, demanding trades, everything else. It almost doesn't happen in the NFL. In fact, go into the universe of the NFL right now and find me a drama situation other than maybe the New England Patriots. And that seemed to be kind of a three-way triangle, right, between Brady, Kraft, and Belichick, and really probably a power struggle between Belichick and Brady over who deserved the most success for their tremendous dynasty. That's what that really, that story seemed to be, and I think it got squashed, right? Because you end up in a situation where there is a massive success with another Super Bowl, and there was hardly any drama coming out of New England this year. But you look at this situation in the NFL, and as successful as Mike Tomlin has been, and I think he's been insanely successful with the Steelers, don't you have to at some point move beyond looking at Le'Veon Bell, Antonio Brown, and Ben Roethlisberger and ask yourself, what is going on in Pittsburgh that is so fecund that you could grow a triple sort of mess like this? What is going on that is allowing these kinds of issues to be so fertile? And I think ultimately you have to come back to the leadership, and I think ultimately you have to come back to Mike Tomlin. I think this is about Mike Tomlin's management of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, I'm not sure how you solve it. I'm not sure what you can do to make this situation better. But I got to tell you, it's hard to argue that this isn't resting entirely at Mike Tomlin's feet. Now, do I think Ben Roethlisberger intentionally fumbled the ball because he was mad about the play call that Todd Haley had put into the discussion there? No, I don't. But I'm not 100% sure. And there are a lot of quarterbacks out there that I would believe they would never do it if the accusation was made, right? If you came out to me right now and you said, hey, Tom Brady was so mad over the play call that Josh McDaniels made that down the stretch of a game he was trying to win, he intentionally fumbled. I think you can say a lot of things about Tom Brady. That on its face is a story I wouldn't believe. If you said the same thing back in the day about Peyton Manning, Peyton Manning was so mad about a play call that down the stretch of a game that they were winning and trying to run the clock out, he intentionally fumbled. I would never believe it. Now, there are some quarterbacks I believe it about. If you told me Cam Newton did that, I'd be like, I don't think he would do it, but I'll at least consider it, right? I would at least contemplate the idea that he might. If you told me that that Jameis Winston did it, I might believe it. Told me Russell Wilson, no, right? I can run through a huge list of NFL quarterbacks, and I feel like we have a good sense for who would be willing to even consider that. Not that I think they would do it, but that I would be like, oh, okay, I can kind of see that happening. I'm willing to consider that with Ben Roethlisberger. And do you know why I'm willing to consider that it might have happened? Because of the dysfunction that surrounds the Pittsburgh Steeler franchise right now. Wouldn't believe it about Brady. Wouldn't believe it about Manning. Wouldn't believe it about Russell Wilson. Again, I'm not sure that I believe it for Big Ben, but I'll consider it. I'll have a debate about it on the radio. I'll sit there and say, hey, you know what? Things are so messy with Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. I can see there being a power struggle in Pittsburgh. Ben Roethlisberger being unhappy with the play call. They were up 10, by the way, in that game. So even with the fumble, it wasn't necessarily going to cost him the game. I don't think he would do it. I'm like 85% no, but there's 15% of me that says, you know what? I can believe that. It's like when Cam Newton didn't try and dive on the football in the Super Bowl. There are a lot of guys that I would have, if you'd told me beforehand, hey, there's going to be a loose ball on the field in the Super Bowl, and this guy, Cam Newton's not going to dive on it. Brady would try to dive on it, right? I don't know that I would believe that Ben Roethlisberger did this, but I'm at least willing to consider it. And there are a lot of other quarterbacks in the NFL that I wouldn't be willing to consider it. And why do I consider it with Ben Roethlisberger? Because of the dysfunction that comes from the Pittsburgh Steelers. So this is going to be an interesting test for the Steelers. Without Le'Veon Bell, without Antonio Brown, this is indisputably Ben Roethlisberger's team. Mike Tomlin has basically made his choice. Ben Roethlisberger, we believe in you. What kind of performance are the Steelers going to put out on the field? I don't know. But I'm fascinated to see, particularly because the Browns are rising. In the past, the dysfunction with the Steelers, because the Bengals were up and down, the Ravens were up and down, and you knew the Browns were going to stink, they could get past this dysfunction and it didn't really catch up with them. Is that going to continue? Man, I don't know. I don't know what the overall outcome is going to end up being here. We'll talk about it. Myself and Jason Martin coming up in the next segment. Does he buy into the idea that Ben Roethlisberger would have intentionally done this? Or is this a totally made-up story and an allegation from a former teammate who had to recover the fumble, by the way, that there's no basis for this at all? Only the Pittsburgh Steelers right now is the dysfunction strong enough that they're two-time Super Bowl winning quarterback, that we could even believe this might be true. We'll break that down for you. This is Outkick the Coverage. We are rolling into Hour 2, Tuesday edition. Appreciate everybody out there hanging out with us.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios, hour number two. Rocking right along here on Fox Sports Radio. I'm Jason Martin on Twitter at JMartZone, formerly EP here on this show, executive producer, now the host of the Jason Martin Show on Sunday mornings here on Fox Sports Radio. Clay Travis is out in Los Angeles. He'll be in Las Vegas as well this week for the NCAA tournament. Of course, he is at Clay Travis. And this is just kind of an incredible story. I'll just read a piece of it here from CBSSports.com. And yet, a former Steelers running back is doing his best to ensure fans that Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell weren't the only players with questionable attitudes in Pittsburgh's locker room. As Steelers Depot documented, one-time Steelers running back Josh Harris has accused Ben Roethlisberger himself of poor character, citing a specific incident from 2014 in which the quarterback allegedly fumbled the ball on purpose. You talked about it in the last segment, Clay. First off, what a story this is. And how bad is it for the Steelers? They were one of the classiest organizations in the league. And then you have the James Harrison story last year where he ends up playing for the Patriots. You've got Bell. You've got Antonio Brown. You've got every bad story in the world. And now the quarterback that you've said you're going to back, that your general manager came out and said, he's the one adult, the other 52 kids need to pay attention to what he is saying, is now being accused of potentially trying to spite Todd Haley by fumbling intentionally in 2014. I can't quite frankly believe this, but the thing about it is Ben Roethlisberger is kind of an ass, and that's kind of been documented about him since his high school days. He was hard and unapproachable at Miami of Ohio as well, and then it's kind of lured his way right on in. It's him and Aaron Rodgers are the two guys you hear the most about being difficult to deal with in the NFL. So I'm thinking, if there is a guy who is this spiteful as much as he wants to win, I'm at least willing to listen to this Ben Roethlisberger story.
You know, it's funny and it's crazy, and I had almost the exact same reaction. I said I wanted to get yours. Like, I can run through a list of starting quarterbacks, and probably when I mention this, you'll say, like, is there any way Tom Brady would ever do this?
No.
No, right? Is there any way Peyton Manning would ever do this?
Hell no.
Is there any way Russell Wilson would ever do this?
No, he's too much of a competitor.
Right? But could you see Cam Newton doing this?
I got quiet because I thought that made the point. I think it's possible.
Right? Yeah, and that's and you mentioned Aaron Rodgers. I don't know. I mean, because he clearly has got a little bit of diva tendency in him, but I wouldn't really see him do it. But there are guys, and Ben Roethlisberger is one, where I can see, you know what, I'm so upset about the play call, I could kind of see Ben Roethlisberger doing this. And, you know, I could see Cam Newton doing this. Are there other guys in the league? I couldn't see Marcus Mariota necessarily doing it, but could I see Jameis Winston doing it? Maybe. I don't think Drew Brees would. You start to run through the list, and you're like, okay, I can see. Would Jay Cutler have done this? 1,000,000,000%.
Yeah.
Jay Cutler would have been like, I don't like this play call. I'm going to intentionally fumble the football. I could see Jay Cutler. Right? And you run through the list, and what's amazing about this is Ben Roethlisberger is really the only Hall of Fame quarterback I can believe would do this. And I'm like you. I said there's an 85% chance that this is not true. But 15% of me thinks, you know what, I could see Ben Roethlisberger intentionally fumbling the football here. And to me, what all this does is it circles back to Mike Tomlin over and over again, and I just find myself asking, I know Mike Tomlin has won a lot of football games as a head coach, but how is it that the only NFL players we hear about with diva and drama-related tendencies as a huge group? Is there any other NFL team where you can name three guys like this, Le'Veon Bell, Antonio Brown, and now Ben Roethlisberger, that are all the focal points of a team, to have all of them emerge like this? Either Mike Tomlin is a wizard, and he has been somehow managing to put together the three most difficult personalities and win a lot of games over the years, or something that he is doing is creating these kind of situations where diva tendencies are allowed to ripen and grow.
I mean, what was the story for the Steelers for the last half decade or so? The three Bs, the killer Bs, Bell, Brown, and Big Ben. And they were the most feared, triumvirate that you could find in the NFL. The Tomlin question is an interesting one, because I think if this were college, I think we'd be using a different phrase right now. I think we might be discussing whether or not Pittsburgh or the University of the Steelers, for sake of a better argument, is a situation where Mike Tomlin has a lack of institutional control over the franchise. Because, he's won a lot of football games, as you documented. He's won a Super Bowl. He is a very good coach. But these problems, you expect this in Cincinnati. You expect this in some places. You expected it with the Portland Trailblazers years ago when they were called the Jailblazers. But the level of discontent around not just the players on the Steelers, but the superstar, the guys that brought you to the dance, the ones that bring the girls to the yard, that to me speaks to Mike Tomlin not having a voice that seems to carry a whole lot of weight with the biggest stars in the franchise. And to me, that is a big problem.
Yeah, look, I'm with you, and I think so far most of the attention has been, okay, let's talk about Antonio Brown and how we view his behavior. Let's talk about Le'Veon Bell and how we view his behavior. And now, obviously, we're talking about Ben Roethlisberger and how we view this allegation that's been levied against him, which is a pretty serious allegation. And all of that is fine, and we can talk about whether or not we believe any of those three guys. But to me, the linchpin that connects them all is obviously Mike Tomlin. He's the guy who has, if these things are all happening, he's the guy who in some way has enabled the situations to exist where these guys can go out and, I would just say, have a diva tendency. And I think everybody knows what I mean by diva tendency, and this is not something that exists hardly anywhere else in the NFL, right? Most of the NFL is a very buttoned up, listen to me, I'm the boss, you follow me. And maybe occasionally the quarterback can talk out, and maybe occasionally you got a little bit of drama. But for a storied franchise like the Pittsburgh Steelers, these stories and the continued drip, drip, drip of different allegations, even this has been going on for a while, like you said, Antonio Brown turning on Facebook when they're in the locker room celebrating the win over the Chiefs in the playoffs, right, and having what Mike Tomlin says go out. It's a little bit of a suggestion that Tomlin maybe has become so much of a player's coach that the players aren't really bowing down to his authority like you would anticipate a Steeler would have in the past, right?
Yeah. Now, the thing is, he's one of the longest tenured coaches in the NFL.
And he's been wildly successful. Like, let's not overstate the fact or underrate his performance, because I think a lot of times people talk about Belichick. You look over the last 10 years or so, he's number two to Belichick. And that surprises people. He's up there with Andy Reid. He's up there with Pete Carroll. To me, those are the four most successful coaches by far in the NFL. And Pete Carroll's had drama, let's be honest, right? I mean, with Richard Sherman and the way things blew up on him there, and he had to ship out a lot of the talent on the defensive side of the ball and basically say, hey, Russell Wilson is my guy. The Chiefs have had drama, but it's all been off the field, right? It's been Kareem Hunt doing things inappropriate. We haven't even hardly talked about the allegations about Tyreek Hill, because they're just allegations at this point in time. But it's been, you know, it hasn't been Andy Reid related. So maybe that player's coach element. I would say Mike Tomlin's probably got a lot of Pete Carroll in him. And Mike Tomlin seems to have sided with his quarterback, which I think is a smart move in the general sense. But the fact that the Steelers end up giving up Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell in exchange for a third and a fifth round pick is a pretty extraordinarily wild sign of mismanagement.
Yeah, I just think eventually you've heard what this guy has to say. So that's why I'm talking about the tenured coach thing. Eventually you just tune somebody out. Whether it's Antonio Brown, Le'Veon Bell, they've just had enough of Mike Tomlin. They've heard his motivational speeches on the Mount Rushmore, which is not a term I like to use, but on the Mount Rushmore of coach speak, I think our good pal Butch Jones down in Knoxville is way up that list. But in the NFL, maybe nobody is more coach speak than Mike Tomlin. He never says anything. His motivation, I imagine, has fallen on deaf ears amongst people in Pittsburgh. So there's always that talk of, this guy's a really good coach, but maybe he needs a change of scenery. And I think that might be the situation for Mike Tomlin. I think he could go somewhere else and be successful. I just feel like his time with the Steelers peaked a couple of years ago. I don't know that he's responsible for the failures, but if they're tuning you out, if you're not able to get them to play at their highest level or motivate them or get them to just merely listen to you in a locker room or in a practice or in a warm-up or on the sidelines, then that dude's got to go. That dude's got to go somewhere else, despite how successful he's been. I mean, if you look at players, Joe Montana didn't finish his career with the San Francisco 49ers. Peyton Manning didn't finish his career with the Indianapolis Colts. And it's not because those guys were tuned out. It was because age got to them. Here, eventually, I've just heard enough, man. Like, eventually, I'm not going to listen to you on the radio, Clay, because I've just had enough. And actually, maybe that's already happened. Maybe I can't listen to you anymore. But I think that's just it. I just think Mike Tomlin's, they've heard his voice. They know what he's going to say. And it no longer moves the needle anymore. He's basically talking about baseball for a three-hour radio show and expecting that to rate.
Well, I think sometimes what happens is when you break it down, I think you did a good job of it there, is what you always say about college coaches, they kind of know they have a four-year window to get guys to listen to them, mm-hmm. right? And so every 4 years, you can go back to the tried and true methods because you got a whole new group that's there to listen to it. And if you are doing that over and over again in the NFL, I just think it gets hard, which is why we don't have very many guys who have had a long tenure. If Mike Tomlin left the Pittsburgh Steelers, I think there would, can you name somebody other than maybe the Seattle Seahawks and other than maybe the Kansas City Chiefs and certainly the New England Patriots? That is three franchises out of 32. Don't you think the other 28 would be like, oh my God, Mike Tomlin's available, we want him in an instant?
I think you could add Sean Payton to that list.
Yeah, Sean Payton should be on the list as well.
But that's probably about it. I don't think we're forgetting anybody there. I definitely think that, I don't know if all of them, I mean, there are some that would definitely keep their coaches, but there are definitely more than a handful of teams that would start to evaluate the guy they have. I'd say probably 20 is about right.
20 NFL teams would be ecstatic at the idea that they could sign Mike Tomlin. And so when I see all these stories happening, I feel it's almost Urban Meyer-esque. You know how Urban Meyer can win at a high level, but eventually his methods catch up with him. And I think we saw that at Florida. I think we saw it at Ohio State. My philosophy continues to be about Urban Meyer. He's going to do television for a year. He's now with Fox. He'll do television for a year in L.A., and then he's going to go take over at USC when they fire Clay Helton. That's been my philosophy for a while. That's his pattern. Now, could I be wrong? Certainly. But I think what you see is Urban Meyer wins big, but the cracks in the foundation start to spread. And I think certainly when you look at what happened with Antonio Brown, when you look at what happened with Le'Veon Bell, and now these allegations about Ben Roethlisberger and him being upset at Todd Haley's play calling, I think there's a pretty good sign that we've got some substantial foundations starting to blow up here as well.
Does it make you more or less likely to believe this story because of the messenger? Josh Harris is the guy that put this out. Josh Harris played one season as a backup for the Steelers. He was on the field during this fumble, and 5 years later, here comes this tweet that leads to this big story. What exactly does that make it more credible or less credible? Because I don't know what he has to gain. Now, he might be saying, look, it ain't Antonio Brown. It's not Le'Veon Bell. Maybe he's close friends with those guys. I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be any gain at all for Josh Harris, who most people probably don't even realize he played in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about him. So sometimes the answer is you can make up an outlandish allegation and put your name back into the flow, right, of conversation. I said when I saw this and I went and I watched the play, the Steelers were up 10 points at the time when this fumble happened. I looked at it. The report is that Roethlisberger wanted to kneel and that Todd Haley was having him run the ball. It's hard to see that it's intentional. And again, 85% of me is inclined to believe there's no way this is true, but 15% of me believes it. And 15% of me wouldn't believe it if it was about Peyton Manning or if it was about Tom Brady or Russell Wilson, right? Like, those guys have been successful enough. I don't foresee them being willing to do something like this. I at least believe enough of Ben Roethlisberger and kind of the way that he plays that I could see him doing this. I could. 15% of me. 85%, I think this is manufactured. 15%, I'm like, you know what, I could see it. And again, for no other Hall of Fame quarterback would I probably say that. No way I'd say it about Drew Brees. No way I would say it about anybody else that I think is going into the Hall of Fame. The fact that I would say it about Roethlisberger, again, I think it ultimately leads me back to the situation Mike Tomlin is creating.
Rolling right along here on Fox Sports Radio, Clay Travis out in Los Angeles. He'll be in Vegas later this week for the NCAA tournament, as he does every single year. I'm Jason Martin here in Nashville. I'm on Twitter at JMartZone. He's at Clay Travis. When we come back, I am offended for Clay, quite frankly, because thespun.com put out their 64 most annoying people in sports media bracket, which they did last year. And I am offended for Clay as a two seed, not because he's that high, but because he's that low. And I'll bet you Clay agrees. We'll talk about that next. Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio. Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios. Outkick the Coverage radio program. Clay Travis out in Los Angeles on the West Coast all week long. He'll be in Vegas for the NCAA tournament. So I want to talk about brackets here. And I know we've talked a lot of brackets on this program and every program over the last couple of days. But I have a question for you, Clay. The Spun, again, put out its 64 bracket of most annoying people in sports media. What's worse, this bracket and you not being a number one seed, as you absolutely should be, or
yes,
ESPN botching the women's bracket reveal yesterday?
The botch, for people out there who don't know, ESPN accidentally put out the women's bracket 3 hours before it was supposed to be out.
Whoops.
Which is just so women's basketball. They say we never get respect, and ESPN had to issue this statement. In working with the NCAA to prepare for tonight's women's selection special, we received the bracket similar to years past. In the midst of our preparation, the bracket was mistakenly posted on ESPNU. We deeply regret the error and extend our apology to the NCAA and the women's basketball community. We will conduct a thorough review of our process to ensure it doesn't happen in the future. We will now broadcast the full bracket at 5 p.m. and then the regularly scheduled show on ESPN at 7. So this was supposed to be a major moment. Didn't this happen? I can't even remember now. Everything runs together. Didn't somebody get the men's bracket a few years ago and release it on Twitter?
Yeah, it was a social media deal. This was a totally different level of ineptitude. This was epic. They're sitting there, they're doing their bracket show that had run the night before for the men's, and then on the right side, there's the graphic of the women's bracket reveal. And so they go ahead and do the selection show a couple of hours early, which leads Oregon and other schools that had watch parties and all of these things that they had put together logistically for the women's bracket reveal.
It's a big whiff. I mean, and my first thought is, like, I feel bad for inevitably the 25-year-old PA who was hard at work and just put the wrong file in, right? Like, somebody, and I understand people are out there and they're going to, I certainly have made fun of ESPN a lot over the years. It's funny, but having done television, I circle back around and I see how hard some of the young people that work on our show are and do. And you know this, you were an intern before. Like, a lot of times that grunt work is done, and I just immediately, like, almost cringe because I think about the 20, and I almost would guarantee you that it's a 25-year-old who's in charge of graphics that just grabbed the wrong NCAA tournament graphic and popped it up. And you can say that's a failure and everything else, and I would be intrigued to know the full story of how something like this happens, but I bet it's just human error. And oftentimes in stories like these, the human error comes down to a young person who's a low-level employee and is just, like, absolutely in an awful spot right now. So I feel bad for them. It's funny, but that's a big, it's a big whiff, but I don't think there's any malice intended here. I think it's just a screw-up, like a screw-up that might happen on this show all the time.
Yeah.
God knows how often we screw up and how often people might be screwing up going in as people are driving in this morning to go to their jobs, as often as it might happen at your job, too.
The 64 most annoying people in sports media, the four number one seeds this year, Stephen A. Smith, Jim Rome, Skip Bayless, and our good pal Colin Cowherd. The number two seeds, Max Kellerman, Dick Vitale, Jason Whitlock, and Clay Travis. Clay, this is a situation where it seems clear to me that you are the Michigan State number two seed. You are the top number two seed. This is a disgrace because you're also... you are also in the same region as Jim Rome, and I think you are far more unlikable than Jim Rome, who you could beat up because we've seen him on Radio Row, and we know not a big guy, doesn't look particularly healthy these days.
Small man. Jim Rome is a small man. Like, this is where one of those things where, you know, you're both honored to be, because look, I mean, the reality is, if you were on this list,
you matter.
They basically, well, and also you got a big audience, right? Like, you don't end up on the most hated, annoying people in sports media audience unless you have a big audience. And it's funny, Cowherd, I think, right now, has the best national radio show in the country, right? If you think about making news, if you think about solo hosting, like, he is, whether you like Colin or not, and obviously Colin's a friend of mine, he's immensely talented, right? The other guy on this list that's a top eight seed that I know really well, and we've had him on this show a lot, is Jason Whitlock, mm-hmm. right? And you don't have to agree with Jason Whitlock on everything either, but the amount of work that he puts in and the grind that he's done, writing over the years, radio, now television on Speak for Yourself, which I was on yesterday, and I may well be on again today. I haven't seen the full rundown because it's early in the morning as we do this show. But he puts in a lot of work. I think you can make fun of Stephen A., and certainly we have. You know, Tress Way, the latest thing when he's saying that he's one of the quarterbacks with the Redskins, and certainly there are a lot of whiffs. Like, Stephen A. is a really talented dude, and I've said that for a long time. So, you know, it's a little bit of a honor to be on this list. But here's what I would say. I am seated right now to go up against Darren Revelle in the second round of this tournament.
Mm.
Darren Revelle is woefully underseeded as a seven,
yeah,
right?
He is.
Like, and you think about people who are get a lot of hate on social media. The fact that Darren Revelle is a seven seed is just an insult to the bracket process to begin with.
Yeah, a couple of other guys that I look at, I'm like, how is this guy here? Keith Olbermann's a four seed. Keith Olbermann's number one with the bullet, right? Like, I mean, what are we talking about? Sarah Spain is a nine seed. Urban Meyer, I'm impressed for Urban Meyer. Urban Meyer is a 12 seed in the 64 most annoying people in sports media, and he's not really in sports media yet. Like, he hasn't done anything, and he's already in the bracket. That takes talent.
There's also some people on here where I'm like, how could you even dislike this person?
Yeah.
For instance, Adam Schefter. Who finds Adam Schefter annoying?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Yeah, I don't even know how you dislike Adam Schefter. He's just an incredible journalist, right? Like, he just breaks news. I don't really understand how you could, like, when you're in the opinion business, I understand how you can be disliked, right? So if you're an opinionist, I understand why you would be on this list. But I don't hear anybody ever say anything bad about Adam Schefter. You know, a lot of these other people in the opinion, I also feel like, look, Charles Barkley's a 14 seed.
Yeah.
I don't hear very much negative about
Charles
Barkley.
No, we all love him.
That's just a name on the bracket list. I also, Tony Romo is an 8 seed. I don't hear anybody ever say anything bad about Tony Romo. Bill Walton as a 4 seed. I love Bill Walton. Did you hear him during the Pac-12?
Yeah, the Las Vegas thing?
Oh, it's unbelievable. Like, I'm flying to Vegas later today to go do the show Wednesday, Thursday, Friday from the MGM Grand. You should come watch Lock It In. But Bill Walton, during the Pac-12 tournament, said that he went and stood by the Statue of Liberty and gazed upon it and thought about everything that it meant. He went and looked at the Statue of Liberty in Las Vegas at New York, New York. He wasn't in the harbor in New York City, and he certainly didn't travel out on the boat to go stand by the feet of Lady Liberty. I mean, that dude is a national treasure.
Yeah, I mean, he loves marijuana. I mean, let's be real. I mean, my man was smoking peyote.
The thing that I can do is tell people exactly what I think. I'm not going to be the person who's like, hey, back in the Super Bowl, this is what we did to come back from a 14-point deficit, right? I don't have any experience in that. I'm not going to be the guy who comes on and says, hey, the play that should have been diagrammed out of that timeout in the NBA Finals was this one. That's not my thing, right? What I can do is be a fairly intelligent fan in the world of sports, use my law degree at times to talk intelligently about complicated issues in the world of sports. And I get it. Look, I'm in the opinion business. And it's funny, the tweet that I enjoy the most is when listeners are out there and they say, you know, when I first started listening to you, I hated you. But the more I listened, I don't know what happened, but I don't necessarily hate you anymore. And I like the Alonzo Mourning, you know.
Where he's
shaking his head. And then, like, he suddenly changes and starts nodding. Like, I love when people say, hey, I listen to your arguments. And when you sometimes start off, I'm like, what is that knucklehead saying? And then by the end, I'm starting to nod a little bit. Now, I don't expect anybody out there to agree with everything that I say, just like I wouldn't agree with everything that you say or that anybody else out there would say, because, you know, we're all unique in the way that we approach issues. But I do think that, you know, when I see this and I see that I'm a 2 seed, I'm like, well, you know, it's crazy to me that we've created the space that we have in OutKick where our opinions are at least significant enough that whether you love or hate them, we're pretty high up there in the flow chart.
I agree. I mean, basically what Clay just said about the people that have gone from hate to love, Clay Travis grows on you. He grows on you like a fungus. By the way, by far the most underseeded guy as we go to break. Hour 3 coming up. Petros Papadakis will join us. OutKick the coverage. Fox Sports Radio.
Be sure to catch live editions of OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We always, on Tuesday in this hour, are joined by my man, Petros Papadakis. Petros, good morning, first of all. Thank you for coming and hanging out with us. How excited are you, by the way, about the NCAA tournament? I know that oftentimes you don't like very much that everybody else likes. Are you excited at all about the NCAA tournament?
You know, it really just depends on the year and what the circumstances are. I like the NCAA tournament. I like Gonzaga. We have them on the West Coast. That's all we got. And an assorted amount of Pac-12 teams, most of which don't deserve to be there. But we have UC Irvine. You know, we have some good things in the tournament. And it really just depends on how it plays out and what happens during the tournament. You know, are we going to get a crying flute player or something like that? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you just don't know you're going to get.
I want to talk to you about...
It's like a present you have to unwrap, Clay.
Yeah, no, I know that. And hopefully we're going to have some good presents come Thursday and Friday. And honestly...
Don't you remember the crying flautist from Villanova?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that for sure. And Villanova's won 2 titles in the last 3 years, so she's ultimately ended up being a very happy person, probably well-adjusted in life. You went to USC. I believe your wife also went to USC, so you are legitimately a USC family.
My sister, my brother,
dad.
Tasso, my dad and mom, my mom's parents, my grandma on my dad's side, and assorted others.
So a lot of SC connections. When you saw this story come out, and it's just, I mean, I don't follow it as closely as you do, but it's like every story about USC for the last 4 or 5 years has just been awful, right? How do you solve this? And it's not just, obviously, a lot of people focus on the athletic side of things, but there are a lot of just one body blow after another to the USC brand. What's the root cause of this, and how do you fix it?
When I was younger and playing at USC, the name of the president of the university was a guy named Stephen Sample. He passed away last couple years of Parkinson's, I think. But he's the guy that pulled the university up by its bootstraps, and it became a more legitimate, not that it was a bad school, but it just, you know, was a school you could get into back when I was younger. And it's a private school anyway, so they don't really have to answer for who they let in or don't let in ever about anything. But the point is, Stephen Sample was an academically based guy. He loved athletics too, but he was an honorable man. And the guy that took over was a man named Max Nikias from Cyprus, the island, not the city in Southern California. And he had this goal of $6 billion in fundraising, and a university that was once about money became grossly about money, and about money to the detriment of everything else. And I think it just set a tone, you know. Things at SC started to become for sale. You know, Jamie McCourt, Frank McCourt's wife, is on the board of trustees. You know, Willow Bay is the head of the communications department because her husband, Bob Iger, the head of Disney, I'm sure, has made some very, very handsome donations. They became star effers, so to speak. And that's kind of what happened. And from the cheating scandal in the athletic department, which is nothing compared to what the campus gynecologist did, but it just seemed to kind of open the door, that culture that Max Nikias created as the university president, open the door for people to use the good name of the university to their own advantage and be, I guess, what you would call shady to varying degrees under the umbrella of USC. And in a lot of these situations, USC turned a blind eye or tried to pay people off, you know, like with the dean of the medical school, or with the situation involving the gynecologist, which is also terrible. I mean, there's so much to unpack, Clay. I just don't know where to start.
And a lot of people who are listening to us right now, I mean, obviously in L.A. are familiar with this. But when I mean, part of it is just kind of laughably absurd, right? When you have the Aunt Becky for Lori Loughlin, who is buying her two daughters' ways into USC by pretending that they are going to be crew athletes, right? And when this story breaks, the daughter who is at SC is on the billionaire's yacht on spring break in the Bahamas, who is the board of trust chair.
She was on Olivia Jade, who's a YouTube star and an influencer. She was on Rick Caruso, who is the chairman of the board of trustees' yacht, for spring break, $100 million yacht in the Caribbean.
I mean, that's just, I mean, it's satire, right? Like, if you were writing extreme, ridiculous satire of the rich and famous, it would be for a story like this to break. Aunt Becky from Full House, everybody knows Aunt Becky, is scheming to get her daughters in as fake crew athletes. And when this story breaks, for the daughter to be on the billionaire's yacht on spring break, I mean, it definitely fulfills all of, like, the derogatory thing people would have said when you were growing up is certainly that USC was the university of spoiled children, and it just fills in there, right? It just all rolls together.
Well, yeah, and I heard all that stuff when I was younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all had the stereotypes for all kinds of different universities, and the closer you are to one, the more you hear. The truth about USC is there's like, you know, 40,000 students there and some really great teachers and great people. But the upper echelon, the people that really get to use the name of the university, have ruined it with fundraising and been gross about it. How about the fact that this guy Mossimo, the Lori Loughlin's husband, he was on a plane with Pat Hayden, a fundraising trip to Augusta, and was told not to mention it to Pat Hayden because Hayden would ask for more money, you know, probably just for a donation or something to the university. But a lot of the people around the school that are that high up don't feel like the rules apply to them. Pat Hayden, the former AD at SC, was siphoning money off a charity that he was supposed to be running and giving his children like $100,000 a year salaries on some scholarship charity for poor kids. Now, that's why he had to step down. I mean, it just seems like USC kicking and screaming doesn't want to be dragged into the 21st century where your money is not going to solve all of your problems.
It is just an utterly unbelievable story. How does this get resolved going forward? I mean, they've had to fire several people, I think, in the athletic department.
I have no idea. I mean, we can sit here and go back and forth and talk about all the absurdity at USC in the last decade. And for the football program, it's really been a decade-long blood drain that you kind of see coming to fruition now in its absurdity and ridiculousness with a lot of the stuff that comes out of Clay Helton's mouth. But what do you do? I mean, you need a new university president. You need to have less than 50-plus members on your board who are mostly just, you know, really wealthy people who bought those spots. And you need a new athletic director. And you need a new direction for the university, which is remember your past. You know, let's be a little bit less disgusting about everything. USC for years acted like the rules didn't apply to them. When the LA Times started pulling up a lot of the veins of these stories, USC ignored them and just tried to act like they would go away. And I think it's a good lesson in modern times, you know, that everybody, even these, you know, ancient institutions of higher learning that feel like they're above the law, nobody is above public scrutiny. And even if you're a private institution, if you act cool about it and act like you're too cool for school, it's going to be a long, slow demise. And that's what we've seen in the media in the last year. It feels like every week there's something embarrassing USC.
I never thought I would say that. Well, first of all, do you think Lynn Swann should be able to keep his job?
Do you?
No.
I mean, if he knew about it,
I don't think it's criminal.
If he didn't know about it, then it's absurdly inept. I mean, this was one of the highest people up in the athletic. That's why USC's getting killed for this, and you know, Yale and Stanford and UCLA, some of the other schools are not. USC had the highest ranking person in their athletic department other than Lynn Swann, and maybe she was parallel with a guy named Steve Lopes. But Donna Heinel, that's a huge, she is USC. I mean, she represents the whole place. So does that water polo coach. I mean, that's talking about one of the most decorated coaches in the history of the university. These aren't small fish that went down at SC. And you know how the feds are. Are they going to flip all these people? I mean, everybody's wondering how much bigger it will get. But I think you need a complete blood transfusion at USC. But I don't know where the doctor is to, I guess, perform that. Because, you know, you have to be a willing patient. And I think USC still got a bunch of people that are not willing to give up power. And that's why you have the situation you've had. Tim Tessalone, you know who he is, right?
The
head of communications for the athletic department and one of the ADs. He gave a pretty telling quote years ago in one of the Kiffin scandals or something to Tom Friend, the sports writer. And the sports writer said, you know, a lot of your donors are upset. You know, they don't like Kiffin or whatever. And Tessalone's quote was, well, we're more worried about the $1 million donors than the $100 donors. And that was really his quote, you know, from the head of communications at USC. And that kind of sums up everything, right? That's kind of where they are right now and why they're in this trouble.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt at all. I mean, as you break it down, we're talking to Petros Papadakis. At the old P on Twitter, Petros and Money Show, AM 570 LA Sports, which I just mangled probably right there. But how
you
tough
just
is
got
it, for
it?
I got it. I got it right.
For the first time.
That's amazing.
There you go.
So how tough is it for you? And I think about this too, because when you have to rip a place that you went to, and I'm sure a lot of you loved SC, right? Like I will occasionally have to come on. I went to Vanderbilt. I met my wife there. It's a fabulous university. There are a lot of great people there. But every now and then they do something and you feel like it's a bad decision and you got to rip the university. And I think that's uniquely tough. That's got to be tough for you, right? Because you're an SC guy and you'd love for the university to be doing well. But at the same time, you got to be honest. When they screw up, you have an obligation to your audience to tell the truth, right?
Yeah, and some people might say that I'm way too hard on USC, but
yeah.
You know, a big part of my media career has been this 10-year kind of downslide. And I'm not just talking about wins and losses. I'm talking about stuff I've seen, you know, working at the university that I just never really liked. And maybe one day all the stories will be told, but for me, I take no pleasure in it. But I've been warning about, not to pat myself on the back, I do not have a beach house. But
you know what? Your house in L.A. probably costs more than my house and my beach house did combined, though.
Well, L.A. is quite expensive.
Yes.
Hell, I might be moving out soon. Who knows what I'll do for a living? It is a very interesting kind of way that this has played out, because I was warning about this kind of stuff at SC for at least a decade. You know, even at the end of the Pete Carroll era in like 2009, where things got a little too fat and gross and just a little bit too drunk with success. And you saw the way that ended up with the sanctions that they got. So I've been warning about it for a long time. I never thought it would implode so spectacularly as it has right now. But again, I don't, you know, USC needs to want to do better. And there's too many rich people there, then there's too much money to be controlled that for these guys to give it up, I think.
We're talking to Petros Papadakis. All right, I'll go off the USC scandal story here for a moment, but I definitely wanted to ask you all about that. And I'll go into something that is turned into an unmitigated disaster. What happens with LeBron? I mean, we've gone from LeBron's going to win a championship for the Lakers, which was the hopes and dreams of Laker fans when this season started, to now a lot of Laker fans out there are saying, you know what, I think that maybe they should trade LeBron James. And it's just amazing to see how this has all moved so rapidly. You got the block against the Knicks, the team basically collapsing. Now you're hoping that maybe they get into the lottery. Have you ever seen a story like this that began with such fanfare and excitement and has quickly turned into a horror film, basically?
Kind of like USC, right? I mean, all these stories sort of end up with despair and an apocalyptic end. But the LeBron thing is amazing, too. I mean, no one would ever think you'd want to trade the most recognizable athlete on the globe. But that sentiment has gained momentum. I don't know if they would do that or how, or if the NBA, as my radio partner has alleged, would even allow that, you know, because you don't just move LeBron around like a pawn. He's a huge deal. But at the same time, I think you hit the head on the nail. There is a tremendous amount of negativity surrounding this guy's Laker career. For as short as it's been, and maybe there's still promise in the next few years, depending on who they can add, the negativity and the word we like to use these days is optics, and just the whole vibe has been shameful. And there's a lot of blame to go around, but I think you're absolutely right, Clay. A lot of Laker fans, they don't like this guy. They think he's a bum, and they don't like his attitude, or they don't like their franchise being used as his vehicle at the end of his career. And I would say that number is growing, maybe half, maybe more than half. But there's a lot of people that just don't relate with what he's doing as a Laker.
Yeah, and you've hit on this earlier, that this is different than being in Cleveland with the Cavs and being in Miami with the Heat. Because let's be honest, the history of the Cavs is not very substantial. Certainly the Heat have almost no history at all. And so LeBron was bigger than the Cavs, and he was bigger than the Heat. But I think there are a lot of Laker fans out there listening to us right now saying LeBron is not bigger than the Lakers. And so the way that this story has played itself out is different in Los Angeles than it was in Miami or Cleveland.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you do have to give Pat Riley credit, because he would not allow LeBron to fire the coach he would not allow LeBron to make a lot of those different moves that he made in Cleveland that made it more of a dumpster fire. And eventually LeBron went back home. But, you know, Miami got their two championships and they were happy. So either you believe that Magic and Rob Pelinka built that team and they're inept, or LeBron built that team and he's inept. But either way, everybody's inept. And I think the number of free agents that want to come play with this guy is dwindling. And that's been clear for about 4 or 5 years.
He's Petros Papadakis. He is hanging out with us here on the morning show here, Outkick the Coverage, Tuesday edition. My man, I appreciate you getting up early for us. And hopefully we'll have some entertaining NCAA tournament options out there, even though the West Coast is not that well represented.
Well, you know, I could sit here and be like, well, Zion is so big and strong, and the athletes on the perimeter for North Carolina, you know, they fly around the court. I could do that, but really it's just going to be about like a mascot getting shot in the balls with a T-shirt gun at the end of it. I mean, we don't know what's going to come out of it.
Outstanding stuff as always, my man. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Clay.
When we return, final segment, Tuesday edition, we'll break down who we think is actually going to win the NCAA tournament. And by we, I mean me. This is Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Welcome back in, Geico Outkick Studios, final segment from Los Angeles, where I'm doing the show this week. Appreciate everybody who has hung out with us so far. Would encourage you to make sure that you go and download the podcast so you don't miss any of the show. Great stuff with Petros Papadakis. We just finished. All that USC story is just so insanely wild. Just crazy to even think about, to be honest. But as we come down the home stretch of the show here, I want to remind everybody we are going to be live on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday in Las Vegas doing Lock It In. My show with Todd Furman, with Cousin Sal, and with Rachel Bonetta. You can come hang out there with us. You can watch the show live at the MGM Grand. That's Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Make sure that you don't miss the opportunity if you're going to be in Las Vegas for the start of the NCAA tournament. Now, I told you I was going to tell you who I thought was going to win the NCAA tournament this year. And I'm going to give you my picks tomorrow on the show for the Final Four, maybe. And then give you some more of my picks on Thursday and Friday, because obviously the NCAA tournament is so integral to everything that we do this week on this show, particularly because we'll be out in Vegas, which will be wild and awesome if you've never gotten the opportunity to do it. But I think this it's fascinating right now to look at the favorites in the world of college basketball, right? Because you have Duke, who is the biggest favorite that has existed in the NCAA tournament since Kentucky in 2014-15. And as good as Duke has been, what I would ask you to think about is this. What if North Carolina had beaten Duke in their semifinal game? What would the thought process be as we enter the NCAA tournament right now, as opposed to Zion following his own miss, getting the tip, narrowly winning that game, and then going and getting to beat Florida State in the championship? How would you be thinking about Duke? I think Duke is incredibly overvalued. So I don't think that the Blue Devils are going to win the national championship. I think if you're out there betting, there's much better areas to go and teams to find, all right? Who are those teams? Where's the value out there? I think there's good value on Kentucky right now. You can get Kentucky at 12-1. They're starting off their run down in Jacksonville. I think this Kentucky team is really good. I think if you look at their bracket, Kentucky is going to win their first round game against Abilene Christian or whoever it is. Then in their second round game, they're probably going to play Wofford. Let me tell you this right now. John Calipari ain't losing to Wofford, all right? That means Kentucky's into the Sweet 16. Is Kentucky going to lose to what would be a pretty good Houston team, right? I think that's the way the bracket sets up there. No way that Kentucky is going to lose to Houston, all right? That gets them into the Elite Eight. I think they would play against North Carolina, where lo and behold, they've already beaten North Carolina. When you look at Duke, it was basically 2-1 to win the championship. And you look at Kentucky at 12-1, I love the value on the Blue Devils at 12-1 coming out of that region, okay? I also think there's pretty good value, and some people are going to roll their eyes and be like, you're crazy, on Texas Tech in the West. In the West right now, you have Gonzaga, who I'm just not sold on, all right? They haven't had that many challenging games. They're coming off a bad loss to St. Mary's in the WCC Championship. You've got Michigan, who is, I think, a little bit of a wobbly team. I don't like Michigan there, all right? And then you've got a intriguing, I think, Texas Tech team sitting there as the three seed. I think the West is the most wide-open region in their bracket. I love Texas Tech, the value on the Red Raiders at 30-1 to potentially come out of that region and get into the Final Four. In the East region, I think Tennessee's set up. If they can get past Cincinnati in the second round, who they'd be projected to play, actually sets up pretty well. I'm not sold on Purdue, and I still think that while everybody seems to buy into UVA, I'm not sold on the fact that UVA is going to enter the NCAA tournament and suddenly be phenomenal after they lost in the first round as a one seed overall number one against the 16 seed. Just not necessarily sold on that. And in the other region of this country, I think Duke is overvalued. I like Michigan State as a little bit of a better value play coming out of the Duke region. I also think Virginia Tech, who beat Duke about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, I think there's some value on Virginia Tech there as well. So I know as all of you are filling out your brackets right now, there are a lot of people who dive in and say, oh, I'm going to go with the favorite. I'm going to pick Duke. I'd encourage you to look beyond Duke. I don't think there's much value on the Blue Devils at all right now. I think it's crazy that there's value on Kentucky. I think there's value on UNC. I like Michigan State in that region. I also like the value on Texas Tech and Tennessee. Those are teams that I think there is a decent value on as we enter into the NCAA tournament. All right, I appreciate all of you who have hung out with us here. Again, I'm doing the show live from L.A. Appreciate all the support, our guests. Thanks to Petros Papadakis for diving into that USC situation with me as well. We will be back tomorrow. I'll be doing the show live from Las Vegas, which we'll see how that goes. Viva Las Vegas, Wednesday edition of Outkick, the coverage from Las Vegas. Again, encourage you to go to the MGM Grand if you're going to be in Vegas for the NCAA tournament. Come by and see us taping. Lock it in. Appreciate all of you. Thanks for spending your time with me. I am Clay Travis. This is Outkick, the coverage on Fox Sports Radio.